From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Another disastrous week in the Middle East dominates the news, despite an extraordinary effort by the Israeli government to close off the flow of information. Journalists have been banned from the cities of Ramallah and Bethlehem, expelled, threatened with government lawsuits, and subjected to bullets, tear gas, and stun grenades. Press organizations around the world have decried the clampdown, charging censorship and calling for investigations.
Last Sunday, Israeli authorities announced that they would begin enforcing existing rules under which journalists must submit reports about defense matters to a military censor. They have also routinely denied press credentials to Palestinian journalists, including those working for foreign news agencies. Nasser Atta has been a producer for more than a dozen years for ABC News. He's on the line from Jerusalem. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Your press pass runs out in a couple of weeks. You are alternately regarded as a Palestinian by the Israeli government. Also, you have an American passport. ABC will certainly grant you a new press pass, but will the Israeli government approve it?
I hope they will give it to me, and I hope that they will give it to my colleagues that they don't have it. I mean, I know more than one journalist. There is a producer who's the desk news manager of Reuters. He's from Ramallah, and his press pass was denied for the last 2 months. I know two friends from Agence France Press that they were denied, and that has been going for the last 4 months.
Well, do you think Palestinians are singled out for this kind of treatment?
We have around 40 employees at ABC News. All the press cards arrive in the beginning of the year. The Israelis, they have their press cards. Our American colleagues and our foreign colleagues working at the office, they have their press cards, and the Palestinians have no press cards.
Last Sunday on Israeli radio, Danny Seaman, the director of the government press office, said that Palestinians employed by foreign networks were no doubt employed by the Palestinian Authority. What do you say to that?
We were employed by the foreign agency before the existence of the BA and before the Oslo Agreement. So basically what I want just to say that we are not employed by the BA. The BA will never force the American network to hire any Palestinians. All the Palestinians who are hired have a BA or a master degree, or some of them have PhD. They are very professional, and I think this is when the campaign becomes dirty.
Do you think that people outside Israel are sufficiently aware of the press crackdown there and how difficult it is to report the truth?
You know, I don't have to say to you that what is going on is really bad. And if it happened in any other country, nobody will accept that. But nobody from Europe or the United States spoke about the Israeli measure against the press that's been going on for the last 2-3 weeks in the West Bank and Gaza. We would like Colin Powell to speak about it, like in the case of Zimbabwe, when they prevented the press from covering the election, like BBC. But here we are prevented, all of us, not only the BBC. And we think it is violation of the freedom of the press.
And your objections aren't just limited to restrictions on Palestinian journalists. You're talking about all the journalists trying to get the story out of the region now.
Yeah, no, I'm not talking as a Palestinian journalist. I'm telling you, actually, in the last 2-3 weeks, we're finding it very difficult, and it's becoming very dangerous to cover the story. And when we know that the army and the Israeli government is against our coverage, we do not feel safe in moving around, because everybody now in Israel is against the foreign press and against the journalists going to Ramallah and going to Bethlehem and going anywhere to cover the story.
And so are you suggesting then that the American press is allowed to cover events that happen against Israelis with more thoroughness and access than they can in the occupied territories?
That is the case in the last 3 weeks, actually, you know, because we are not allowed to have access. I think we should cover the Israeli side and we should cover the Palestinian side. And we should be given all the access and all safety and all guarantee, not as the statement by the Israeli government, which is saying that we cannot guarantee the safety of journalists. It makes me very scared because, you know, there is 5,000 soldiers in Ramallah. Basically, they are in control of the town. And So it is giving us the message.
A correspondent from another network told us that these press crackdowns happen regularly, and once the Israeli government comes under fire from outside organizations like the Foreign Press Association, they'll back down. Has this been your experience of working in Israel?
The Foreign Press Association issued a statement urging the Israeli to allow access, and actually they are thinking of going to the High Court. But it seems that this time the Israelis are insisting that this is their laws and this is the way they are doing it, and they are not really paying attention anymore to the press organization that's issuing a statement urging the Israeli government to allow free access to the press to cover the story in the West Bank and Gaza.
Okay. Thanks very much.
You're most welcome.
Nasser Atta has been a producer for ABC News for 12 years. He spoke to us from Jerusalem. Now we turn to Mark Regev. He's the spokesman for the Israeli embassy in Washington, D.C. Mark, welcome back to OTM.
It's a pleasure to be back.
In recent weeks, we've seen an escalation in the restrictions imposed on reporters trying to cover the conflict. The Israeli government press office has threatened legal action against CNN and NBC, whose correspondents continued broadcasting from Ramallah after the city was declared a closed military zone. Does the government plan to follow through on those legal threats?
It's not clear to me, but I do know that we are in our legal justification to declare a zone closed to the press. It's not without precedent. I think the Americans have done it in Afghanistan. I think it's been done in Yugoslavia by NATO forces. When there are bullets being exchanged and shells going off and military operations being conducted, the area is a dangerous area. I think we often close it to civilians as best we can and press the civilians.
There was an article not long ago in Haaretz that complained about the lack of information that even the Israeli people were able to get from the Israeli press, that the clampdown is affecting the flow of information inside the country as well.
I think Haaretz, which is our quality daily similar to the New York Times, its job is to keep the government on its toes. Its job is to keep the government off balance, to challenge the government. That's the whole point of a free press. And it's only natural that they would tell the government that you're not giving out enough during military operations. I believe the Washington Post and the New York Times do the same to the Pentagon every day.
And do you think that complaint is valid?
It's as valid as the complaint here is made against the Pentagon.
There have been complaints against the Pentagon. However, I don't think the situations are analogous.
Why not?
Because this is happening right next door. The level of tension and the need for information in Israel now must be hideously acute.
Avril, exactly my point. You see, if American journalists complain that the Pentagon isn't giving out enough information out of war that's going on thousands of miles away in Afghanistan, Israeli operations are going on 2 miles from Jerusalem, next to neighborhoods where we live. Surely the military's need to keep some sort of operational secrecy is just as important, if not more important.
Okay. With regard to the safety of journalists, you say the government has restricted the movements of journalists there in order to protect their safety. The Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe expressed concern on Thursday over attacks on foreign journalists by the Israeli army. The Brussels-based International Federation of Journalists on Tuesday criticized Israel, the Foreign Press Association in the UK, the Committee to Protect Journalists here in the US, even the BBC, have all lodged complaints against the Israeli government.
I'm aware of those complaints, yes.
And there have been a number of incidents in the last few days that would support the notion that in some cases it seems as if journalists may actually be targeted.
I don't believe that Israel deliberately targets journalists. And in fact, I know the contrary is the truth. I know that the army standing orders deliberately forbid that. The army standing orders say you have to let journalists conduct their work, that the chief of staff of the Israeli army, the most senior Israeli man in uniform, recently released an order, and he re-stressed those orders once again, that a free press is an integral part of a democratic society, and soldiers have to safeguard the press and allow them to do their job.
If a person such as Colin Powell were to speak out against the current press crackdown, would it make a difference to the Israeli government?
First of all, we want there to be a free press. But to close in selected zones of fighting the area to civilian traffic, including the press, this is something that everyone does. I just can't see Colin Powell talking about this. There's no, you know, the United States does reports about civil rights and press freedoms all around the world. These are regular reports that are published by the State Department on a yearly basis. No one claims that Israel muzzles the press. No one serious claims that.
We can't ignore the stack of complaints from respected press organizations that are piled up here on my desk. Everyone is currently complaining about the crackdown in the West.
I'll tell you exactly what happens, and I see it every night on cable television. The area is closed to the press, and then, of course, every good journalist, and this is what they have to do because this is what their professional responsibilities are, is they try to find a way in nevertheless. I've seen a number of the networks do that. And then the Israeli authorities have to say, no, you can't go in, and sometimes there's an exchange between soldiers and journalists. But the same thing happens in any other situation. Once again, this is the rules of the game. This is how it's played. And I'm saying this is not without precedent that when there is fighting going on, you close areas for the press.
In response to your statement, any reporter worth his salt, in order to fulfill his professional obligations, would have to break Israeli law in order to cover the story of immense global importance and then risk getting tossed out of the country as a result, is a country where a free press is not being allowed to operate.
I beg to disagree, and I'll ask a question. We pull out of Ramallah tomorrow, okay? We pull out of Ramallah tomorrow, and we will pull out shortly. That's part of the operation's a limited operation. So the press can report freely what goes on in Ramallah when Mr. Arafat's in charge? Please.
The foreign press will report what it sees.
What it sees, and its eyes and ears there are Palestinian stringers who are Palestinian nationals who have all these constraints on them which everyone knows exist. Palestinian society is authoritarian society. Mr. Arafat is a dictator, and as a result, the press is part of that authoritarian mechanism, and there are rules there to be taken. I think if you look at what Israel is doing under very difficult conditions of war and terrorism, the press has remarkable access, remarkable freedom. I haven't seen a serious impediment on American journalists doing their job. I see hours of footage every night from Israel that we close a specific area for operational needs. This is legitimate. As I said, it's done by the Americans, it's done by the British, and it's within the framework of the law.
And
if it's not, I urge the press organizations to take the Israeli government to the Supreme Court. Maybe they'll win.
All right. Mark Regev, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Mark Regev is the spokesman for the Israeli Embassy in Washington.
Coming up, when is your local radio newsman not local at all, and other radio riddles. Also, your letters.
This is On the Media from National Public Radio. We're back with On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. It's, 10 o'clock. Do you know where your local radio newscaster is? You hear him on your station, but in fact, he could be anywhere. In commercial radio these days, the phrase local news is more a term of art than an actual description. 30 years ago, it was different. Stations up and down the dial had their own local news departments engaged in eager combat with print and TV reporters for scoops on all the traditional beats. But when news and public affairs requirements fell one by one during the first wave of broadcast deregulation in the 1980s, many stations cut back or dropped their news altogether. Lately, it's starting to sound like the good old days, but it's not. On the Media's Paul Ingalls reports.
Stocks ended the day down yesterday. The Coyotes beat the Canucks 6-1 last night.
It's just past 7 on a recent Friday morning commute into Phoenix, Arizona. Scanning the dial for local news, a curious thing happened.
I'm Bob McClay, KCTK 960 News.
Newscaster Bob McClay is heard wrapping up a newscast on one station at the same moment he's midway through a newscast on a competing station down the dial.
A U.S. Marine pilot based in Yuma had to be rescued after ejecting from...
Scan further and you hear him on a third station that morning.
I'm Bob McClay at the new Talk 1190 News Center. Here are the stories making news in Arizona this morning.
Newsman Bob McClay, a big man with a big voice, sits in a tiny announce booth from 5 to 9 each weekday morning in the news center that any Phoenix radio station can call its own, the Metro Network's Phoenix Bureau near the Scottsdale Airport. Once a Metro traffic reporter, McClay is now Phoenix News Bureau chief and is anchoring for three stations this morning, taping some newscasts, doing some live. A flip of a switch opens a line to each station. Other reporters are doing the same from similar booths that line the perimeter of the noisy newsroom. Computer workstations, police scanners, and two-way radios are everywhere you look. McClay seems to get all his news from Metro's own newswire that shows up on his computer.
Basically, I'm going to do one newscast starting at 22. Then, as soon as I close off from them, KMYL's waiting for a feed, so I'll just flip them up and start doing their newscast. But it's all made so that it's the listener has no clue that we are not in the radio station. They think it's, you know, the radio station doing the news.
So in Phoenix, it may sound like the days when a dozen stations were competing for local news scoops, but it's not. 10 of the 12 commercial stations airing local news have it piped in from the same source, Metro News's 7-person staff in Scottsdale. And it's the same thing in almost 100 top U.S. markets. Metro Network started as a traffic reporting service in the 80s. With helicopters, planes, mobile crews, and cameras already in place, the company began using them to cover spot news and deliver headlines in the mid-90s.
Metro Networks came along and backed into this, surprising even their own executives.
Mark Fisher of the Washington Post, who wrote a radio column for 4 years and also covers radio news for the American Journalism Review. He says the deregulation that relaxed ownership rules and allowed large media companies to buy up more stations created a niche for Metro's news experiment.
And they found out that there was indeed a market for news and that you could distribute news to stations just the way you do traffic reports. And so stations would not only not mind, but would actually savor the savings that they would get.
What's it worth? Well, I don't have to pay the salary of a newsman or a traffic guy.
Alan Summers is production chief at Metro client KXAM in Phoenix.
If you're going to go to a broadcast school and get somebody to do that, you're going to get $8 an hour, but you're also going to get sound like $8 an hour. Well, I don't want to sound like $8 an hour. I think I can give up 15 seconds to have two guys that sound professional quality.
The 15 seconds Summers refers to are the short ads that Metro anchors read at the end of each report.
This news is sponsored by Money Mailer. Look for Money Mailer's jumbo red, white, and blue envelope arriving in your home.
Last year, Metro Networks mailed in over 50% of Westwood One's $100 million annual profit. So, a successful business model for sure, but how does it rate journalistically?
To be perfectly honest, we don't see Metro really as a competitor.
Brian Barks is news director at KTAR, one of two commercial stations still doing local news but not using Metro in Phoenix. To his ear, the load of stations Metro's staff carries compromises the product.
You know, I don't know if it's, call it window dressing or whatever. Kind of like how Hawkeye Pierce would say on MASH, it's kind of like, you know, meatball surgery. It's, you know, cut it up and get it on the air.
Yeah, I completely disagree with that.
Shane Coppola, who oversees Metro Networks for parent company Westwood One.
So if you look at the dollars that we spend today, the infrastructure that we have, it's incomparable to anything that was ever there in the past. No single station or even single cluster of stations could afford to put up three helicopters in New York City. No single station could afford to put two street reporters on the street, you know, basically 24/7 here in New York like we do for WABC 770.
Metro now has 90 local bureaus in nearly all the top media markets, each one staffed with an average of 6 people, drawn from a pool of reporters or disc jockeys laid off from other stations. Some folks were reassigned to news from Metro traffic. Their work is guided by a bureau chief, like Bob McClay in Phoenix, but McClay's directions are guided by client station program directors who can dictate to Metro the length, style, and overall content of the newscasts.
You know, some stations don't want any police news. Others that we've had here, if there isn't enough blood and guts in police news, make something up. I'd say that jokingly, but they want the more the merrier. They want the crime stuff.
While Metro's extensive traffic infrastructure may give them an edge on covering breaking police and fire news, it puts fewer resources to what McClay called, quote, the boring state government stuff. Metro Chief Shane Coppola says most stations don't want it, nor do they want in-depth investigative reporting, so Metro offers little or none of either in most cities.
at some point, we have to recognize that the news business is different from making chicken wings at Tyson Chicken.
Bob McCannon heads a national media literacy project in New Mexico. He and other media critics blame deregulation and consolidation for the current state of local radio news.
What we're getting is a commodified product which doesn't express the multiple concerns that citizens have in any given community.
The advance of the Metro Networks concept is a major strike against the basic foundation idea of journalism in this country, which is the idea of a marketplace of ideas.
Columnist Mark Fisher.
There is no marketplace of ideas when virtually every station on your dial is offering news to you from the same newsroom, collected by the same person, with no variation, and all of it driven by a central deceit, which is the idea that you are getting different newscasts on different stations. No one ever tells you that it's really the same guy sitting in the same room, sometimes using phony names so that he appears to be a different person on each station.
As to the issue of many stations sharing one news source, the Metro folks say most listeners don't find out, and those that do don't seem to change listening habits as a result.
I think it's more important that people just hear the news.
Mark Mayfield, recently laid off from his production job at a Phoenix rock station, is now a Metro News and traffic anchor.
You know, and if they hear me on a couple of different stations, well then, hi, you know, it's me again. It just seems like it's better to inform than not. This is the best that you can expect to get right now.
For On the Media, I'm Paul Ingalls.
If remote local news comes from anywhere, it is the Telecommunications Act of 1996, which removed most limits on radio station ownership. The biggest beneficiary was Clear Channel, which owned around 30 stations in 1996 and since has amassed more than 1,200 to become the nation's biggest broadcaster. It's also the main player in the live entertainment industry, owning roughly 130 venues around the country. Add to that the over 700,000 outdoor advertising displays it owns around the world, and you have what some people call synergy and others call dangerous monopoly. In the past few years, charges of anti-competitive practices have fallen mainly on deaf ears at the FCC and elsewhere in deregulatory-minded Washington. But last month, for the first time in decades, the FCC rejected Clear Channel's proposed purchase of a radio station in Virginia. According to Eric Bollard of Salon.com, that won't stop Clear Channel from behaving like a big bully.
They have changed the radio business beyond recognition. Consolidation has caused tens and thousands of layoffs. The head programmer used to be a shock jock, and that seeps through the company. It's a very curious combination, an incredible consolidation, which was bound to unleash a lot of ill will, married with this company that sort of wore its frat house mentality, morning pig show, with pride. And so you put those two together, and they've made a lot of enemies in the radio business.
Well, give me an example, please, of how the corporate culture is informed by the shock jock mentality.
Oh, just really being hard-nosed when they don't have to be, pushing people around when they don't have to be. And it's not just the radio business now, because as you mentioned, they're in the concert business. So now the allegation is they push artists around, they push record companies around. Do it our way or you won't be on the radio. Go with our promoters or we're going to make life miserable. And the record business is in such dire straits these days. I mean, sales continue to decline. The last thing people need is to be, you know, locked out of radio stations or kept off the air. So everyone is very nervous about stepping on toes, and they don't want to upset Clear Channel.
How does the dominance of the radio station industry by Clear Channel or anyone else affect listeners?
Well, it affects what they hear on the radio. I mean, Clear Channel is pretty upfront that they play less new music, for instance, and they sort of wear that as a badge of honor because in the past, you know, mom-and-pop broadcasters, they weren't professional enough, and they're playing too much new music, and they weren't really what's called testing the music, trying to find out what listeners liked. So, you know, their playlists were too hodgepodge, whereas Clear Channel does a massive amount of testing, and they also, rather than employing disc jockeys in every market, you know, if they have a disc jockey in Akron and on an adult contemporary station, they'll, through sort of ingenious technology, be able to insert that into 20 other 30 adult contemporary stations across the country, and it'd make it sound local. It'll be local ads. It'll be local mentions. But then, you know, they can fire the other 29 disc jockeys and just pay the one.
What you describe in your stories, the vertical integration, because they own the radio stations, they're syndicators that sell programming to radio stations and so forth, the predatory practices that your unnamed sources are describing, gouging advertisers, the use of distribution clout as a bludgeon against competitors. It all seems to be textbook antitrust behavior along the old Standard Oil lines. But even if the FCC, for ideological reasons, is regulation averse, how can the Justice Department not be licking its chops at this target?
Well, people tell me that the problem is the Justice Department and other regulatory bodies, they don't really understand the music business. They don't understand the overlap and the power that a concert promoter wields when they own radio stations. Also, the music business in Washington, you know, it's on the wrong side of every issue. The only time they really get attention is when they're criticized for R-rated lyrics, and last year the FTC took them for task for price gouging. The last people that are going to come to their aid or congressmen.
So what you're saying is if Clear Channel is monopolistic, the first victims are the record industry, and there's not a whole lot of sympathy for the record industry in Washington.
Not a whole lot of sympathy for the record industry. The reason there is action in Washington now is that some congressmen have been hearing from other broadcasters, from artist managers, from record company executives. In January, Congressman Howard Berman from California wrote to FCC Chairman Michael Powell and Attorney General John Ashcroft, asked them to look into Clear Channel for a vertical integration, whether they do threaten to keep artists off the radio who don't cooperate with the concert promoting, this allegation of so-called parking or warehousing radio stations where Clear Channel owns too many stations but does it through front or shell companies. And the allegation is that in some markets, Clear Channel is running the stations. They're selling ads. They're programming the station. They're paying the employees. But in theory, they're independently owned and operated.
All right. The FCC has denied Clear Channel one proposed purchase of WUMX in Charlottesville, Virginia, putatively out of the concern that if the deal went through, Clear Channel and one other competitor would dominate the marketplace. There would be no third main player. Does that presage stricter regulation and attention on Clear Channel, or do you think it was just window dressing in order to deflect criticism that has been leveled against the FCC?
Well, the people I talk to in the radio business certainly don't think it's foreshadowing any stricter regulation. In fact, the FCC will probably continue to loosen ownership limits. But there is a sense that that denial of that station purchase was an attempt to at least put up a roadblock and say, we're still sort of the sheriff in town, even though people in the radio business feel like the sheriff left town a long time ago.
Now, you said it yourself. A decade ago, the radio industry was really in a bad way. The stations weren't profitable. And now along comes Clear Channel, and it is a very profitable company, and it has found value in these diamonds in the rough. If the goal was to let the free market do what the free market does, hasn't the deregulation, at least from that perspective, been a rousing success?
I don't know if the point of Telecommunications Act was to make lots of radio station owners wealthy. There's almost no one in the business, probably outside of Clear Channel, that would argue that radio is in better condition now than it was 5 or 6 years ago.
Eric, if commercial radio has come into such a sorry state of affairs, where, oh, where is a radio listener to turn?
Well, they could turn to three places. They can turn to public radio. They can turn
Thank you very much. Eric Bollard is a senior writer at Salon.com.
And now for a few of your letters. Justin Kenny of Washington, D.C. was enjoying last week's show until our interview with Reba Shemansky, whose hobby is writing angry, pro-democratic letters to the editor. hundreds of them. In one letter, Schimansky had some very harsh words for Republican Barbara Olson, killed in the September 11th terrorist attacks. Kenny writes, "What were you thinking of when you invited this hateful person on your program? I was no fan of Miss Olson either, but to wish such a fate as hers on anyone is beyond comprehension."
Chris May of Charlotte, North Carolina, wrote in to thank us for our interview with Walter Shapiro, who offered this reason for media cynicism regarding campaign finance reform. Political reporters rely on campaign consultants as sources. The fees of those consultants are directly tied to money spent on political ads. Hence, Shapiro reported, they feed reporters a bipartisan disdain for reform. Chris May writes that after reading many articles describing the lackluster effects of the bill, he was, quote, "feeling somewhat despondent. Now that I know that media consultants' compensation is also affected by the legislation, I feel better than ever about its passage. Thank you."
But Thad Hill of Washington, D.C. wrote that he was, quote, "amused that you managed to avoid the truly cynical component to campaign finance reform, which is the media's unwillingness to mention the dreaded words free airtime. If candidates had free airtime, they wouldn't have to raise all that money." He notes that the National Association of Broadcasters and their members refused to mention the idea and adds, "I would have assumed that NPR, supposedly public radio, would not be under the thumb of the NAB, but I am clearly wrong." No, you're not, Thad. Just check the archives.
Which you can find at onthemedia.org, and you can email us by writing to onthemedia@wnyc.org. By the way, don't forget to tell us where you live and how to pronounce your name.
Coming up, French slander, video game pain, and a place where there is never any slander or any pain, C-SPAN.
This is the House of Pain on the Media from National Public Radio.
We're back with On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Conspiracy theories surrounding September 11th have ranged from the ludicrous to the frightening, and from Canada to Saudi Arabia. The speculation concerns who was responsible for the terrorist attacks and their motives. This week in France, a book by a man named Thierry Messin has caused quite a stir. His allegations reached heretofore unknown heights of paranoia. Martin Walker, chief correspondent for United Press International, is here to explain. Martin, welcome back.
Hello there.
So what's the name of this tome?
Well, it's called September the 11th, L'effroyable imposture, which I describe as the despicable deception. It says that there was no terrorist attack on the Pentagon, or not at least by Islamic militants using a hijacked airliner. The claim is that the attack was staged by American agents using a truck bomb, and the motive was to generate support for a larger defense budget.
Well, it's certainly plausible. I mean, it's quite clear that after the planes hit the World Trade Center, within 4 minutes, the American intelligence community got busy to jack up the defense budget by staging an airplane crash. It's very, very clever and just what we'd expect from the CIA. Are you telling me that there's people who believe this?
Well, there's certainly an awful lot of people who are buying the book. It's book of the week on the FNAC Internet Bookstore, which is even bigger than Amazon in France. It's also the bestseller in a number of Paris bookstores. It's one of those cultural phenomenon that I think help to illuminate the degree to which people are starting to be prepared to believe just about anything about America at the moment. And what I was struck by was the way in which one of the most traditionally anti-American newspapers, the most critical of America, Libération, has condemned this book as a series of despicable lies. In an editorial just last week was saying, one hears in this argument about the fake crash at the Pentagon the echo of another lie, and that is the question about why was it on 11th of September in the towers of the World Trade Center there were no Jewish corpses. obviously because they were warned of the imminence of the attacks by whom? Ah, indeed, by Mossad and the CIA. This crapulous thesis, this appalling thesis, should take its place alongside the idiocies of the Holocaust deniers. We cannot understand why this book is being taken seriously, but it is.
Well, it certainly provides another very nice reason to hate the French. You've spent a great deal of time in France. Can you imagine how such a preposterous, implausible conspiracy theory could have taken root there?
Well, I think that the conspiracy theory about Jews being warned away from the World Trade Center on September the 11th is, I've got to say, is widespread in the Arab world. It's not just in France. I think that the one particular factor in France at the moment is that they are in election month, and it's an election in which both Chirac and Jospin, Chirac the conservative incumbent president, Lionel Jospin the socialist prime minister, they're in a very, very tight race, and one of the key constituencies is going to be the several million French people, French voters of Arab descent. And this is why there's been, I think, such an extraordinary agonizing in France about the current state of the crisis inside the Middle East, and why you now have this very strong European reaction to the wave of anti-Semitism in France. It's seen synagogues burned down and so on. And I was very struck by one particular comment that I saw in the German newspaper Frankfurter Rundschau, which says, the anti-Semitic attacks in France and Belgium are a direct response to the escalation of violence in the Middle East, and they demonstrate the absurdity of the notion that the Arab-Israeli conflict can be limited to the Middle East. This war has now come home to us. So if only out of pure self-interest, the European states must coordinate their foreign policy and throw their diplomatic weight into the balance.
Very well, Martin. As always, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Martin Walker is chief correspondent for United Press International. He joins us regularly to survey the world press.
This week, Bryant Gumbel resigned as host of CBS's Early Show, and a press release asserted that no one in TV history had anchored more network morning programs over a career. But despite Gumbel's departure, TV morning shows soldier on. Now that CNN has brightened up its mornings with Paula Zahn, TV morning news seems to have gone completely over to the light side. Well, almost completely. The public affairs network C-SPAN presents a morning show that is in many ways the anti-morning show. It's low-tech and serious, which, given the current state of morning news, makes it revolutionary. On the Media's producer-at-large Mike Pesca paid a visit to C-SPAN headquarters in Washington to take in the anti-morning show.
Northrop Frye, the literary critic, has a theory about how types of literature relate to the seasons. Harold Ramis, the Caddyshack director, has an equally profound theory about network television. He says that the broadcast day has its own life cycle. It starts in wide-eyed innocence with the morning shows, progresses to seriousness during the evening newscasts, and lands in the realm of ironic detachment with late-night comedians. These thoughts came to him when he was working on a spoof about a morning show. It was rejected. Perhaps a spoof was seen as redundant, given the real thing.
Happy talk, keep talking, happy talk.
What is an it girl?
Do you really think you should spend $600,000 to study the sex lives of squirrels?
I mean, what does an it girl do?
Apparently rudeness is making a comeback in America.
It is. Shut up and listen to this. according to a new survey, 79...
Your last day.
I think there's it girls in Afghanistan. I think there's it girls in Wyoming.
Diane, let's see if I can get the forecast right. That's the big thing.
Charlie Gibson is covering the big news in the Middle East. But Charlie, there's big news here with your Orioles.
We think Paula Zahn's an it girl.
You describe yourself as an emotional eater.
The Queen Mother was an it girl.
Oh, come on.
Even the names of the shows connote farm fresh American goodness. Today, Good Morning America, American Morning, Even the most staidly named, CBS's early show, is still a show. There is an alternative. C-SPAN's Washington Journal is 3 hours of a host reading newspapers out loud over the television. Newsmakers and newsbreakers sitting next to that host, and callers from across America opining on the topics of the day.
Washington Times, Philadelphia Inquirer. Let's go next to Allentown, Pennsylvania. You say no. Why? Here is the Christian Science Monitor's editorial. Let's go to Terre Haute, Indiana.
Brian Lamb is C-SPAN's chairman and CEO, its most recognized on-air presence, and one of the rotating hosts of Washington Journal. In short, he's C-SPAN's it boy. He, like all the other hosts of Washington Journal, are not polished newsreaders, but workaday C-SPAN employees who pass an in-house audition. Peter Slen, Washington Journal executive producer and frequent host, explains what the network is looking for.
Somebody who will ask a C-SPAN-esque question, you know, somebody who understands the C-SPAN way.
The C-SPAN way certainly is not morning show bright and bubbly. But it's also not the hard-nosed interviewing style of, say, the BBC. Washington Journal hosts are precluded from asking challenging questions, following up with gotchas, or holding anyone's feet to the fire. Brian Lamb says that the frequent how-could-you-let-him-get-away-with-that complaint underestimates the audience's ability to discern the truth on their own. For example,
there's a whole series of comments coming through right now that George Bush and his family did the World Trade Center disaster on purpose. Well, that's a real stretch. I don't want to sit there like a bump on the log letting somebody continue to say that without asking, where's your information coming from? What's the basis of this comment you're making? I want the other folks in the audience to find out who told them that this was the case, why did they think this way, and then they can make up their own mind whether that person's worth listening to.
Even call screening is different on C-SPAN. There are different phone numbers for Democrats, Republicans, and others. Sometimes there are different lines for yes-no questions. So long as callers wait 30 days between calls and call in on the right line, everyone gets on the air. It's part of C-SPAN's philosophy of being more facilitator than filter.
We're just trying to be as open as possible and let it flow without constantly worrying about whether you have a kook. There are kooks in America. Whether you have somebody that's a conspiracy theorist, they're all over the place. America is made up of people that aren't all well-educated and don't have the best English and may not even have the best argument, but there's a case that can be made that the spontaneity of it all will give you a more accurate sense of what people are like. We don't care what people say as long as we get some balance to the discussion.
Balance is a tagline at the Fox News Network. It's almost a religion at C-SPAN, says Peter Slen.
Balance is our number one goal. We keep official stats on the Washington Journal. Republicans, Democrats, conservative, liberal, moderates. We try to stay within the week nearly perfect as far as the balance goes. This morning we had a yes-no question on the Middle East peace process and whether the U.S. should be involved. We went yes-no, 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 back and forth, so we had an equal amount. Does that reflect public opinion? I don't know.
It might not even reflect the overall opinion of the C-SPAN audience. If the question, should the U.S. intervene, gets 1,000 callers to the yes line and 20 callers to the no line, to the home viewer, it will still sound as if there is a 50-50 split during the 20 calls that get on the air. C-SPAN turned to the yes-no format after calls ran 9-1 in favor of impeaching Bill Clinton, even though polls showed that the public was leaning the other way. But a chronic even-handedness is the best way to keep host opinion out of the discussion. Your average American will probably tell you that that's the way the media is supposed to work, impartial and totally objective. But most professional journalists will cite their responsibilities to give the public context and to vet the truthfulness of allegations made on the air or in their pages. In a roundabout way, Ted Koppel has criticized the C-SPAN model as an abdication of journalistic responsibility. He said, if you point a camera at an event, that's not journalism. That's technology.
Think about why he said it.
Brian Lamb.
He's in the business of deciding what we should think and not think, question people from his perspective, and that's a business that has been very lucrative for folks. We're every bit as much of a journalist here as anybody that's ever called themselves that.
As journalists, they choose topics and book guests, while eschewing full-time anchors, splashy graphics, ratings because C-SPAN doesn't track them, and outside funding because their entire budget comes from the cable industry. This bare-bones, aggressively even-handed format is why C-SPAN was founded, and probably why 8 million people a week watch Washington Journal. And so far, no one there is being replaced by stupid pet tricks. For On the Media, I'm Mike Pesca.
A British company recently expressed some interest in a new video game developed by two German students for a class project, The Pain Station. It's a simple concept, really. Two players face off in what looks like a standard barroom version of the video game Pong, but the Pain Station comes equipped with ominous-sounding pain execution units and pain amplification units. The damage comes in three forms: an electric shock, a blast of heat, or a rotating wire whip. The first player to pull his or her non-playing hand from the pain loses. The British company backed off when it found out that the Pain Station draws blood from many of its contestants. Joining me now from Cologne, Germany, are the brains behind the Pain Station, Volker Morava and Tilman Reif. Welcome to OTM.
Hello.
Hello.
Take me through your thought process when you came up with the Pain Station. Were you sitting around and playing Donkey Kong when you thought, gee, this isn't as fun as it could be if the game were occasionally whipping or burning or shocking me?
No. The original concept kind of was from this child games. In Germany, they call it Folter Mau Mau, which is a game of cards. And the one who loses, he gets slashes with the remaining cards he has in his hand. And then we came up with the idea of making a video game that inflicts pain. And then we were thinking about what kind of pain could we inflict. And obviously, the electricity was the first. And then we came up with the whip and the heat. And then we combined it to form the pain execution unit. It is fun because you play against your opponent and you will see him suffering, and the next time you will suffer, and the pain is not all that bad. So
it's the pleasure pain principle.
Yes.
Does sound like fun. Uh-huh. How much pain are we talking about?
The heat will get very bad if you play for a long time, and it's the same with the whip because the whip always hits you on the same spot.
And it's the whip that can get your hands bloody.
Yeah, that's the whip.
So if you drop the whip and you kept the shock and the heat, do you think you could get a big-time marketer for this product?
I don't know if we really have to drop the whip. Maybe we would just have to make it a little less painful.
Tilman, you really don't want to give up that whip, do you?
No, because if you take away the pain, where's the original concept? And if the Pain Station does not force you to quit playing, the whole game gets stupid.
Are you targeting your game to sadomasochists? I mean, who's interested in doing this?
A lot of people are interested in playing this. It's a really intense gaming experience because you have to concentrate on the game very much because you don't want to get hurt. And the game is accompanied by a lot of noises, and the Pain Station will talk to you and say, oh, come on, my friend, and stuff like that. So you're really getting involved into the game.
Is this an acquired taste, or do you think you can really just sort of sit down and have fun getting hurt just from right out of the box?
As we have experiences from the exhibitions we've been to, the people, they either love it or they hate it. Some people, they play it once and they never play it again. And other people, they play it once and they can't stop playing. They come back, even though their hand looks really bad already, they still keep playing.
Why do you think that is?
If there's danger involved, it's way more fun. It's a big thrill. Also, winning is way more fun if it's combined with pain or this physical stress. You can see this in all the extreme sports nowadays.
So the two of you are students, and you dreamed up the Pain Station as more of an artistic experiment than a practical video game. So what are you trying to tell us about the world through the Pain Station?
We see that there's more to video games than just doing better graphics. So there could be much more feedback, and the body could be way more involved.
Well, when you wanted to bring the body into the virtual world, what made you decide on pain? Is it harder to give pleasure?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it's really easy to give pain.
Did you mull over the idea of trying to give pleasure?
No, not really.
I don't know. It sounds to me like you're tapping into the age-old adolescent desire of playing chicken, see who can withstand the most pain or take the biggest risks. Is this something we really need to be encouraging kids to do?
I'm not sure. One guy came up to me and he said if his son would ever come to him on Christmas and say, "Oh, Daddy, I want to have a paint station for Christmas," what would he do? I mean, the paint station raises questions like this, and I think this is also a message to raise these questions and to discuss these questions. But it's not said that there has to be a paint station in every children's room.
Thank you very much, Tilman Reif.
Yeah, you are welcome.
And Volker Morave.
Yes, Volker Morave.
Thank you. Tilman Reif and Volker Morave are students of the Academy of Media Arts in Cologne and co-creators of The Pain Station.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Janine Price and Katya Rogers with Sean Landis, engineered by Irene Trudell and Dylan Keith, and edited by Brooke. We had help from Jim Colgan and Lou Alkowski. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Mike Pesca is our producer at large. Arun Roth, our senior producer, and Dean Capello, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and get free transcripts at onthemedia.org and email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media from National Public Radio. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Oh, come on, my friend.
Support for On the Media is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Ford Foundation, the Bydell Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Jeffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.